Well, in this segment of the IRWE project to record some of the history of radio and electronics in the early days in South Australia, I'm speaking today to Mr. Jack Filsall. Welcome, Jack. Maybe we could commence by you telling us a little bit about how you became first interested in radio and perhaps the early days of your career.
Yes, Ian. Well, I think to go back, I think we have to go back to about 1928 when the local baker, he used to make crystal sets. And I think they were 25 shillings each he charged for a crystal set. And of course, I was a money young fellow in those days, and being an only child, I used to twist around my finger a little bit. So she got me this crystal set. So I think that was the first start of it. I must have been around about 10 or 12, 14 possibly. And anyhow, this gave me a great interest in radio. But then, not having any more money or being a bit young than to start manufacturing the stuff, I found the PMG was selling telephones. I think they were 2 shillings or 2 and 6 pence on West Terrace. And I got a couple of these telephones from a chap called Edgar O'Daniel. He had 2 doors up there, and we got some 24-gauge wire. That's all we could afford to buy, and a couple of old batteries from the PMGs, and we finished up making a telephone between his house and mine. But the dear soul next door didn't like the wires going over the fence, so she used to get out there in the broom and knock them down all the time. It didn't impress us very much, but that was another start. Then I wound and had them wired up to the back shed and so forth, and this gave me a bit of an interest in, you know, in audio generally. Well, then in the days of 201A valves, I remember those Cliff, I think 1/4 amp on the filaments, and somebody told me that if I hooked got this 201A valve and put a 4-volt or 6-volt filament on the transformer to it and an old dry battery, I could augment the sound some quite considerably. So I carried out this experiment and it worked all right. And my daddy was sitting there one day and I heard, "Jesus Christ, what's happened?" I rushed in there and all I could see him was a cloud of smoke around him, and he was scared stiff and just sitting there with a pair of headphones around. And the answer was, of course, I'd used a Bell transformer, not having any more money. The thing got overheated and up she went in smoke, but I never forget the dad's look on his face, and with his headphones around, he was stiff just like a mummy, you know, fighting to move until I disconnected all the wiring. But approximately that time I started to work at Colton's in 1931, I think it was, and being interested in radio, I think there was a chap called Bill Honner, who was the instructor down at the school. And I went there for a couple of years, studied radio, and finished up getting a radio kit, TRF, with 5 valves, and we made this set up at the school. Then I took it home, then it was so successful I wasn't allowed to touch it after that, so the mother then, in the back veranda, got me a little workshop there, and getting all odd radio parts together, and I used to make a few sets and get them going, and eventually made them good enough that I was able to sell them for, I think, about £12.10 for a three or four valve set, which I made a few of. And at Colton's, of course, I was in the radio department there, and a chap called Bruce Barlow. And Thomas was the manager, but Bruce Barlow, and they used to sell Darrell, D-A-R-E-L-L-E, Darrell sets. And one of the first ones we put in, I remember, was old Jolly's Boathouse. We went down there and they used to use a 57 valve as an oscillator and a 58 as the IF amplifier, and somebody got them reversed and they had to get the specialist in to find out you can't use a variable mu valve for an oscillator and so forth. But from about 1933 I then transferred to Harris Garth in the radio department. Jack Opie was the manager in those days. It was a chap called Don Code. Don Code was the fellow on the counter, and they put a girl in there in charge of the counter sales. And in those days, of course, there was no anti-discrimination act. It was very strong that girls didn't work with boys. And I didn't know how to shift her, so I used to get these old Chanix condensers. I used to charge them all up before she started at 9 o'clock. People would come in for Chanix condensers, you get hold of one and just about jump over the counter, you get a shock. it worked all right, because if she asked in a week for a transfer, so we didn't have any more girls on the counter in those days. But me and Phillips Proprietary Limited, who had a workshop in Perry Street and used to do a lot of Harris Scarfs major repairs. I used to be doing delivery and minor repairs out on the road, but Graham Phillips used to do all the main things. Well, then he put in, had an application in for a one of the radio mechanic one time, so I went round and applied for the job. And he said, "Oh, I don't think, Jack, you've had enough experience for this." He said, "Yeah, not bad, but I don't think you have quite enough. I want somebody a bit more experience." So I said to him, "Look, Graham, I'll tell you what I'll do." I went in, the pay was £3.05 or £3.10 a week, I think. So I said, "Look, Graham, I'll work for £2.10 a week, and in 6 months' time I'll come to you, and if you don't give me a fiver, well, I mean, you can either sack me or give me the fiver." He said, "You're on." So, I mean, there's no doubt about it, if you did that today, Ian, of course, you'd have the unions on your back and God knows what, but I worked for the 6 months, and I said, "Well, the 6 months is up, Mr. Phillips." He said, "Yes, you're on." So I got a fiver from him. So, I mean, these are some of the things that take you back in those years, where a little bit intuition and a little bit of get up and go got you somewhere, because there was no such thing as holidays or sick pay. Or if you had a cold, well, you still went to work just the same. We used to deal with quite a lot of different firms there in those days. There was Burks's and 1219 sixpenny sets, and there was Ernst Smith's. There was quite a lot of those different manufacturers, and we used to make a few sets, of course, on our own at home of a night. And there was the old Saxon. I think Austin Street, who was there? There was a chap in Austin Street, he used to run it. So Saxon, was it Eclipse Radio?
Yeah, that's it.
And they used to sell Saxon loudspeakers and Saxon stuff. I mean, it was pretty cheap and nasty stuff, but it looked nice, and there's nice plastic dials on it, you know, and we used to get the cabinets made. And consequently, I mean, you could do a little bit of work at home there and get a few bob, and also buy a few stuff, a bit more extra gear for yourself.
Mm. What did you call your sets that you made?
I forget the name. It was a serenade. It was Harris Scarfs. I forget the name of the man. I used to have some name we used to put on him, because he had a variety of names down to Eclipse Radio. You could take a dial with his name on it. But a fella came to me only a few years ago, and he said, "You know that set you made for in 1940? He said, "What's it worth as a trade-in?" It's still going. Of course, I mean, in those days, I mean, some of those old valve sets, as a matter of fact, I've got one out in the garage there now. It must be about 45 years old, and the thing still operates now. We say that the modern sets are trouble-free, but some of the old valve sets too, if you got them, got rid of the dry joints to start with, and somebody taught you how to solder, it's amazing how well they went. But speakers too, I mean, I don't think they've come that far ahead with speakers. Some of the early speakers there, the Jensen M's and things like that. Graham Phillips had some. He used to use the Jensen M's up at the old Labethal motor races. And Victor Harbour, I was on that with him in those days.
They were PA jobs.
PA jobs, yes. But then, talking to the radio, they used to make a Philco car radio. And used to sling the aerials under the running boards. Mm. You know, about 3 feet above the ground. You wondered why you didn't get very good reception. Then the mud would get on them, and huge things. They used to boat and cables to them.
Yes.
But then Asta brought out the Air Chief.
Yes. So he made the Philco radios, were they?
No, the Philcos were made. Graham Phillips had the franchise, I think, for them.
Right, yes.
But it was such a bulky thing that you had a V8 at least, and no room for passengers' feet, because they used to go right on the bulkhead there. And then the Air Chief came along, of course, and they were fairly big, but they were suspended more or less over the firewall. But all those sets of the Air Zone is another good set in that era too. Mm. I've still got three upstairs, the little brown cabinet ones. I've got a 6F7 valve, which I've got a bit of problem getting. But I don't know. They ran remarkably well for their vintage, you know. And And some of the quality of the sound out of those then was remarkably good.
Yes, I guess they had the advantage of wider bandwidth in those days, didn't they?
Well, not so much. I think they had a bit of baffle. You see, the cabinets were bigger, and you get these modern Japanese sets with about a 2-inch speaker and about a 4-inch baffle, and you wonder why you don't get any bass response. Well, some of those sets, yes, they were about 15, 18 inches high, and they're quite deep.
Yes.
And and that's one of the speakers I've got upstairs now, and put it on the other day, and it was remarkably good. That speaker over there, by the way, where was it? That one there.
Yes.
That came in as a trade-in at work for two quid, I think it was, or $2. And I hook it up to the TV set. I get a reverse tranny on it, you see, to get the low ohms up to the high ohms.
Yes.
And it's quite amusing to listen to it, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, you wouldn't. That's going back to 1925, and people in town have got one in like that in a glass case, but I just leave it up there for novelty, you know. But there were quite a number of sets in those that era. I mean, if we look in that book I've got there, you'll find a lot of sets there that must be 30 or 40 different makes. Bill Bland was another interesting character in those days, you know, remember Bill? And Graham Phillips was a great cobber of his. I know, but Bill Bland and Graham Phillips made VHU-9 at Yunta. They made a transmitter up there. And that was one of the first local transmitters, I think, that were made here locally. But somebody wrote in the paper the other day that during the 40s and 50s, why we made so much stuff here was the biggest mistake we've made. But I don't disagree completely with him, because that's where so many of us fellas got training in making the goods, and he forgot all about that, because today, just jumping about 50 years, we're sending fellas to England today to try and get technicians.
Yes.
Just to get technicians out here, because there's nowhere to train them.
Mm.
Or see Dean Schluter, who has been with us for some 25, 30 years, he was trained by Phillips at the old Hendon factory. Well, all that's disappeared.
Mm, there's nowhere to get the...
There's nowhere to get that,
continuity of training.
Yeah. No, because unless you can afford not to work, I mean, where do you get the training from today?
Then you've got to have the experience to get the jobs, and so
that's
it goes
right.
on.
Yes. You know, and I was only talking to John last night at Farewell. What's his name? He's been with us for about 18 years, and he was the one, the Sven Callan lads. And they used to wire sets. Isn't that terrible?
I should know him.
I think
he's
known in a minute. Just hold it. I think some of the interesting era was in the old, before the war particularly, where you used to have to deliver radio sets, of course, and install them. And you'd scratch one there, and the quickest way to cover the scratch was to open the engine bonnet and dip the sump. Get a bit of engine oil on the finger, rub in the crack in the scratch. It usually take about a fortnight to dry out, and by that time the customer complained, well, I mean, somebody must have knocked it, you know. You'd get away with murder in those days, but...
You were mainly involved, in manufacturing, building them, in servicing?
Mainly servicing and also selling them too. I did a bit of, you know, general dog's body in those days. It might be fixing up a set, and somebody would come in, you sell them one, and then you might have to go out and store one. Or I know Graham Phillips said to me one time, he said, that set you put in yesterday, he said, it's not very good. It was on a Saturday, and I had to rush it a bit. I knew that. So I said, I go out Monday. He said, no, he said, you won't. You go out this morning, it was Sunday morning, and fix it up. And don't ask for any pay, of course. So that taught me a lesson to do things thoroughly, you know. So... today you couldn't do that.
No.
But I think the lessons you learn over things like that are...
You learn discretion and respect and all those
you
sort of
fix
things,
it up. If you was in the old Air Force saying, and you know, if you were sick, you clean up.
Yes.
And but today, of course, that doesn't work. I've got to tell you a few instances there where the unions get control today, and that's the end of it. There were no unions in those days to worry us, you know. We just had to do what we were told, and that was it. But...
does that just about bring us up to about the early wartime?
Yeah, would be right, about 1940, yes.
So perhaps you might like to tell us about your experience as a radio operator.
Yes, that was rather interesting. It's, as you know, in the early days, I went to the... About 1938, you could see that there was a war coming, and I thought to myself, well, hell, I'm not going to be a foot slugger. So I sold a Hornby train set, the worst thing I ever did, and got enough money together to do the AW Amalgamators course over at Sydney. I did a correspondence course here in 6 months, I think. Well, it usually takes 12. I used to work day and night, and I got through the course all right and went over to Sydney and went through the school there and eventually got my ticket. And
that was a commercial operator's
ticket. Yes, commercial operator's ticket, yes. I got the broadcast to start with, and then I got the first class later. The old Morse code held me up for a while. I used to read the damn stuff ahead of it, behind Ian, and I used to put in code groups. And if it was A, B, C, D, I'd put A, C, B, D, you know, getting them backwards. I don't know, the fella giving me the test, Ian, he said, I better go back and check myself. He said, you got them all right, but you got them in the wrong order. And being reading behind, you know, what it's like. A bit of excitement in 25 words a minute, you know. I mean, for 5 minutes, you start thinking, I'm doing all right, and then you'd miss a letter or something. But anyhow, that'd be Christmas in 1940, and I just got my ticket there, and they said, oh, there's a ship, just prior to that, they said, oh, there's a ship over down the bay there, happened to be the QE, Queen Elizabeth, Queen Mary, and they want another operator, and there was two fellas there, and they said, right, I will give you a Morse test, and the best Morse test gets the job, and I didn't get it, unfortunately. Yeah. But anyhow, there was just about a week after that, they said, oh, we want another bloke, and there was a ship called the Port Adelaide down at the harbour, so I was put on board the old Port Adelaide. I believe the Bell is now down at Port Adelaide. These ships have been wrecked, of course. She went right through the war, and then they dismantled it and sent the Bell over to Port Adelaide. But we went from there to Adelaide. I walked in on my mother. She nearly collapsed, and I was in uniform in those days, and I said, where are you going? I said, they're going to England. Well, and she nearly passed out because she knew nothing about it. I didn't have time to contact her. And we went straight across to Durban. And I think I've never forgotten, there's a chap called Reg Harrison. He was with the ETSA for a long time. Reg worked with me at Nairn, with Doug Nairn, doing a lot of the installing of radio and that sort of stuff. And he went, when the war broke out, he went to the 6th Division. And he joined up and went to England with the first lot that went over there. And about 6 months after that, we got as far as Durban. And the ship was coaling there. She's a coal burner. And the junior operator came back and he said, oh, I've just met a fellow who knows you. I said, look, I don't know anybody in South Africa. Yes, he said, he knows you. He'd be up at the hotel waiting for you. So I went up and there was Reg Harrison in the hotel. I said, what the hell are you doing in South Africa? Oh, he said, there's 60 of us here. I said, what, there's no army from Australians in South Africa. Yes, there is, there's 60 here. We've all left the Australian army and we've joined the South African army. I said, well, he said, what's going to happen now? He said, oh, that's worse than the Australian army, so we're going to join the British army. So I said, well, how are you getting on for dough, Reg? So he said, oh, he said, you come with me and I'll show you. So I thought this would be good. So we went to another pub and Reg looks around. He said, this is right. So he tapped a bloke on the shoulder. G'day, George, and how are you? And the other fellas, hello, Reg. And they got talking for a while. And Reg said, have a drink. Oh, yes, we'll all have a drink. So he said, don't forget, he said, just before we went in, you got no money. So right. So here we are. Up come the beers and the bloke put down a couple of pounds. And Red said, oh, he tapped his pockets. My God, he said, I've left my money home. So the bloke said, well, I'll pay for them. So Red said, can you lend us that till I see you? Yes, he said, you can take it. So he did about 3 or 4 pubs that night. And Red had enough money for another few days. But then he came back and went to New Guinea, got decorated up there, and finished up working for ETSA down here. So if you ever see Red, you can tell him that Jack Filson never forgets the day that he was in South Africa. Well, anyhow, we finished up getting to England, but from Durban we went down to Cape Town, from Cape Town to Sierra Leone, and that took us from Sierra Leone to Newcastle on Tyne. Took us exactly 6 weeks, up and down the middle of the Atlantic, you know, new boats ahead, then you'd back again, you'd go and around the top of, finish up 60 miles from Iceland to get to Newcastle on Tyne. So that was quite an interesting trip, and then of course we got there and they said, well, you're going to go on the Murmansk run to Russia. Oh gee, I said, it'll be good. In the meantime, of course, I think the Japs started to get a bit touchy, and Australian government said, oh no, they got all Australian operators got to come back to Australia. So we went back via America, and that's why we went across the Bismarck at that time. Do you want to mention that?
Yeah, might as well.
Yes, the Bismarck was in the Atlantic at that time, and we just received a message. I was on watch that night and received a message.
On the, is it still on the Port Adelaide? You're still on the
still Port on the Port Adelaide. Adelaide. Yeah. I think we're about a month or 2 months in Newcastle on Tyne waiting to sort up where I was to go.
Yeah.
Because I was the only Australian on the ship. And a lot of correspondence in those days, of course, with one man. But anyhow, I was told to go back on the ship and come back to Sydney. Well, on the way back across to New York, we went to Philadelphia first, then to New York. I was in the middle of the Atlantic. I heard this message, you know, being chased by a large enemy warship, SOS, a few times. And the position he gave out, I knew it was pretty close to where we were. I rang up the captain and told him on the intercom phone between the bridge and the radio room, he'd better come down and take a very important message. So he just took one look at it. I've never forgotten it. He just looked at the message and he went straight down the engine room and go to the stokers because they were below water level.
Yeah.
And I've never seen the ship. She gained about 5 knots. Normally we did about 10 knots, the old coal burner, but I think we hit 15 knots there with a bow wave to get the hell out the road. And only in the paper the other day that showed the track of this thing was right on where I remembered it. I'll bring that down after, yeah. But just rather interesting.
The stokers would have a bit of interest in shoveling a bit more coal on.
As you know, I'm a coal burner, they have to clean the boilers out every few hours, but there was no cleaning the boilers out. They just threw more and more coal in and steaming across. But convoys, because they were convoys going into England, but they take you about 3 or 4 days out from the Europe or English coast, and then you're on your own, and that's how we got to be on our own, because I mean they didn't have the escort vessels back in the 1941-42.
Yeah. How many operators would you have had on Port Adelaide?
Two. Yeah, you had 6 on and 6 off.
Yeah.
And but then there was radio silence halfway, and they used to send you up the bridge there with a 303 rifle in case anything came up. God knows what you're supposed to do with it, but anyhow, you're on the bridge there trying to assist there. It was a very hopeless job, but by the same token, somebody had to be down the radio room, but there was nothing was allowed to be transmitted or just receiving stuff, but that was all there was to it. So when I came back there to Sydney, I finished up with AWO going onto the Beam Wireless, which was a much more interesting job anyhow.
Yes.
No,
and the Beam Wireless, that was
That was at Rockbank. They had the first, they used to use the rhombic aerial there. Rhombic and that, there was a caller, universal, was a vertical aerial, and you change route during the day, and you'd fire over northern Australia one way, and you'd fire over the South Pole the other way, change route in the sunspots. And we used to work anything up to 200, 250 words a minute there, you know. Mm. And it was quite about 100 kilowatt transmitter.
That's with machines, five of them. Was it? With those code machines.
Yes, with the undulator and the ink.
Yes.
What do they call them? There was the undulator and the relay, yes, key the transmitter.
Yes, I know the ones you mean, I can't remember.
But they were quite good, Ian, you know, really, because I used to cut the power off in the absorber valves and take the whole load right off the transmitter, working 100 words a minute, and they used to have a fairly square wave coming out of them. Mm. So it was really well designed, but they were designed in 1926 by the Marconi Company. I know the filament consumption was 20 volts at 55 amps. And AWA, the first ones, after they used to burn out, they sent them to the factory in Ashfield. They actually cut the tops of them off and put new filaments in them. But we could never get more than about 10 or 12 kilowatts out of them after that. They used to be 20 in the original, but they kept us going right to the war.
Yeah.
So I've been powered by power kerosene on a pump.
Cooled.
And the anode was approximately about a foot long in the middle, and the filaments either end.
Yes.
And every few months you had to dismantle the valve and decarbonise it, just like a car. And I'll never get one chap was decarbonising one day and he turned around to talk to somebody else and he knocked the glass off the end. That was one hell of a big thing. But anyhow, he convinced himself that somehow it was chipped before or something, you know, but it was quite a job to get them through.
So they were even recycling things back in those days?
Yes, it was the first I ever knew of it. We used a lot of 833s in parallel push-pull. We used to work... During the time you couldn't get through to London, there was about 4 or 5 hours where you just couldn't get good contact or enough transmission power to get through to work your undulators effectively. I tried to take it by manual, and a chappy one bloke used to be on that 4 hours to try and get through at about 25 words a minute. But then they had this station, BWX2, I can still remember its call sign, in Bombay. And that was a relay station on 17 megacycles. We used to get through there with about 5 kilowatts on a pair of or 4 833As, 17 megs, to neutralise them. Or you only have to breathe on them, you know, and they go into isolation. But one of the funniest things I ever heard there one night, they were trying to work through this station, and a chappy in Melbourne was very, very impatient with the operator at the other end, and he'd let a few oaths go, what he thought of the operator, you know, you don't know what you're bloody were doing, why don't you wake up and learn to read Morse? And the message came back, I read on the undulator, on the sounder, apparently you're a man operator. And of course, question mark, why? Because no girl would call a girl by those names. So they apparently had a new girl operator from the Wrens or somewhere in Bombay taking this relay. Of course, there's a bit of a silence after that, and the messages stopped going. But they also worked Pearl Harbor there. The only place we worked Pearl Harbor, that was on 15 megs. They worked Pearl Harbor right through the war from Rockbank and Balan.
Yeah, Rockbank was the transmitting
receiving station. No, Rockbank was the receiving station, and Balan was the transmitting station. That's just near Ballarat.
Yes.
I went past there about 12 months ago, but it's all been changed over now, and the fire brigade have got it.
Yes, that's the whole, all the aerials, those big
uniforms they were called.
Yes,
with the 250 feet high with a 90 foot beam on the top. And that fire, from the centre cliff and the reflector, or did they just swing over the...
That's right,
swap over. Mm. You used to have to go out at night about 10 o'clock at night. This happened at Rockbank. You'd have to go out 10 o'clock at night, that's when they changed direction of firing, you see. And they had the old local fellas from the army there, you know, protecting it. It was pitch black, you know, you could get up in this 3,000 acre paddock at Rockbank. And then there was a chap there called North Smith, he called himself. His name was Smith, but he hyphenated, and he called himself North Smith. Yeah. In those days, of course, if you worked AWA in the beam, you were a little bit above the average fella, because it took quite a bit to get a job in those days. Well, anyhow, this Smithy went out to change the aerials, and the chap on the guard, he didn't know who North Smith was. So they were armed there with a rifle and bayonet. And this fella came stumbling out the darkness, you know, and the old fella from the First World War bloke, he was quite used to this. He said, "Halt, who goes there?" And old Smith said, "It's North Smith here." He said, "I don't care if you're Lord Schmidt or not." And he stuck the bayonet in him and marched him into the... As he got him in, he said, "Oh, what didn't you say, you old Smithy?" Yeah. You know. But you can imagine, it's good enough, coming out of the darkness, you know, pitch black night, not a light to be seen, you see, and this fellow with a bone prodding him in the back. So there was a lot of humour there in those early days too. But in the same thing, those receivers too, and they were double IF superheterodynes, 40 tubes, and a rack about 8 or 9 feet high.
Yes.
And the first IF was down to 450, and then down to 50, the second bank. Mm. And then they'd feed them in from the rhombic area, like they were on the rhombics, and then the uniform would feed another set of receivers, and they'd put them into a common diode, And surprising the results they got.
You like a diversity, well, it was diversity reception.
Diversity reception, yes.
Yeah.
Talking of diversity, there's a bloke there, and this Smith had a terrifically loud voice, and he used to yell into the phone, you know. And he's trying to get through to Melbourne one night, because Melbourne used to send the messages up on phone wires. And he was yelling out, and a fellow in Melbourne said, "Wait a minute, Dick," he said, "I'll go and open the window." He said, "What are you opening the window for?" He said, "I'll take you in diversity." Melbourne was 50 miles away, by the way. So all these sort of things we used to break up the it was a very monotonous place, because at Rockbank particularly, the station was about a mile away from the quarters. There was nothing else on the 3,000 acre property, and you used to walk up this hill there, and there was only about 10 or 12 fellas then. There were six houses, I think, but there was only about 10 or 12 people, and it was about 3 or 4 miles from the main road at Rockbank, so it was a pretty isolated area, and I was a single bloke at the time. I mean, no transport or anything sort, so I got a pretty monotonous sort of a life.
A high security area.
Oh, yes, high security, because it was the only place they could do any contact with the outside world, virtually, and so they really protected it, I must say that.
And how long were you in that job?
Oh, I was there from 4 or 5 years.
About what, 42?
42 to about 46, 47.
Yes.
Yeah. But see, that's a slight type of thing that we've got nothing today there to train fellas to get to that standard to go there in. A lot of the factory chaps, I mean, Graham Phillips, for argument's sake, he got the British Empire Medal. Mm-hmm. And when he joined the army, that's the fella from I worked with before the war, and they captured an awful lot of Italian equipment. And old Graham swung the whole lot over into Australian standards and got himself the British Empire Medal. Now, that was all because we didn't import stuff. If we were in the same case today, then, of war broke out, God knows where we'd get anything from, because nothing's made here anymore.
No,
see, we used to make speakers and condensers and everything we used to make here for reception, but, I mean, nothing's made here now. It concerns me a bit, because I think that the employment, there's a lot of fellas who like radio, not fit for, say, high-tech stuff, but they'd be quite valuable in the manufacture of TV sets and radio.
Yes, it's
see,
really
Phillips used to make all their TV sets here once, but nothing's made here now anymore. The whole lot's finished.
Now, you've got to be really a top-class man or you can't get a job now.
Well, that's right. I mean, and the top-class men don't always want to go out in somebody's home and fix up a TV set.
No.
We've even lost a couple of our good apprentices to the Commonwealth Government. You know, there's a young Ducky who used to work with us, he's gone just... Hey, Ducky, remember Ducky, the
holder?
Yes, holder.
Oh, Reichstein, Robert Reichstein.
Yeah, well, he came to me, you know, John Holding. Do you remember John Holding?
Yes.
John Holding came to me one day, and I went, this is not recording, is it? Right.
Do you want to just carry on then?
You want to start anything?
Well, perhaps we might have a look at how you eventually got radio rentals going.
Yes, well, I'll just go back a little bit, Ian. In 1941, after 42, when I came back from sea, I was made an instructor to the Air Force, the RAAF in Queen Street. And from there on into the beam wireless in the Rockbank and also the transmitting site at Belen. And that was up till about 1946. Now, at that time, of course, there was no radio sets made during the war, and I was rather keen to get into the retailing side of the game, because I realised that if you wanted to expand it all, that was the way to go, rather than through the academic side. Not being a great academic myself, but I thought there's more to be gained by going in the retailing side of the game. My wife, who happened to come from Loxton, we were living at Belen at the time, and the new irrigation scheme was just had just been announced up there. So my father-in-law said, "Well," he said, "having my first son, I think he wanted to get the grandson home near into Loxton," so he said, "Look, there's a business up here that's not going too well in the electrical game. You better come home and have a look at it." So I came up then, had a look at it, and eventually bought that business and left the AWA set up at Belen and started electrical and radio business up at Loxton, and did quite well up there. And approximately 1954, I read an advert in a paper that O.J. O'Grady from Reed Murray's was looking to buy businesses. As the Loxton business was getting a fair size now, and it's rather difficult to sell a big business in the country areas, I went and saw him, and we came to a mutual arrangement whereby he took over the business and I carried on for a couple of years. This was worked in very, very well, but then in 1956, television was starting in Melbourne, and I believe that the future, as far as I was concerned, was mixed up in the television era, but there wouldn't have been any up at the country for some years, so the sooner I got out of the country and got into the city side of it, the sooner I could get into television. So I made a contact with O'Grady and told him that I was finishing up and I was going over to Melbourne Tech with a bloke called Fred Kempson.
Oh, yes.
Fred Kempson was in charge of the Melbourne Tech at the time. They were running a
South
TV.
South Australia, incidentally.
Yes, he was a South Australian. He used to go around with a caravan years ago and fixing up sets. And that's the name I was looking.
Oh, right. I knew the name.
You remember Fred Kempson? Yeah,
yes.
A little short bloke.
Yes.
So anyhow, I got in touch with Fred and he said, yes, Jack, come over there and you can go to any course you like. So I went to O'Grady and told him what I was going to do. So O'Grady made a deal with me. He said, look, he said, don't leave me. He said, if you go over to Melbourne, he said, I'll send you £25 every week over there, providing you stay with me for 2 years after television arrives in Adelaide. Well, I mean, I had nothing to lose, so I agreed that this was a very good proposition because, I mean, I had to live in Melbourne and the wife stayed in Loxton with her parents while I was away. So away we went to Melbourne, and that was approximately in the June. I came back in the December, and I was 1 year ahead. That was 1957. So O'Grady said, well, he said, there's a bit 1 year too early for television yet, so go and work under a chap called Curl Walker, which I did at in Perry Street. However, I mean, I was in the electrical department down there, but they didn't believe in any sort of service division at all. They used to hawk all their service vision out, and this didn't suit me one bit. So I worked out what O'Grady sent me, and I decided then to get out of the clutches of O'Grady by paying him back the money he sent me. Now, at this stage, O'Grady had a radio rental services. He'd come to some arrangement with a bloke in England, and he paid him, I think, £200 or £300 to give him the idea of this rental service for radio sets. He opened up in Adelaide, but it wasn't going very well, and as a matter of fact, it was just about ready to be closed. But I had a look at this thing, and I thought, gee, I think I can make something of this, but it'll have to be changed quite a bit to suit Australian conditions. So I went to O'Grady and I said, look, Mr. O'Grady, I think I owe you about £750. There's the cheque for it. Now we're all square. And he said, what are you going to do? I said, I'm going to start a little business down in bottom end of Rundle Street. So he said, well, come on, let's have a look at it. So we walked down there together. And he said, well, if you're going to start a business, what about being in partnership with me? So I said, all right. He said, I'll have 75% of the shareholding. You can have 25%. You get 10% of the net profit. Well, I said, that'll be all right, provided I can take that radio rental services thing you've got up in the back in the side street there. He said, oh, you can have that. So we transferred the name of that into Filston Electrical Limited, including a radio rental service. Now, that's how the thing got underway, because I believe there was no television, of course, to get it underway. So I thought, now, what's the best way to find out what this rental of radio sets is really like? So it was not much use trying to rent radiograms, because they'd gone quiet too, because everybody knew the television was coming.
Television.
So, but there was one thing that had never been experimented with, and that was car radio. And they just laughed at me, and I said I was going to rent car radio. I never heard of such a damn silly idea. But at least when you rent a car radio out, you find out what the general public think. Remember, in those days, no cars were fitted with radio sets in 1958-59, only very expensive ones. And Philips had a set called the NT346. It was a four-valve super heterodyne. It was quite good, but they forgot to put the cathode condenser across the 6M5 valve, and by sticking one of those in, it got another half a watt out the speakers. I lost a bit of inverse feedback in, as you'd appreciate, but with a car radio with a 6-inch speaker, I don't think it mattered very much. So we stuck condenser across that, and the first year we rented out 3,000. Now, we bought these sets at a pretty good price, because I said, well, if you don't supply them, I'll get them somewhere else. So they gave me a pretty good deal. But the secret of it was, I first of all found out how honest people were. I found out what would happen if the car got repossessed. I also found out what would happen if the car went interstate and got sold interstate, so I could take some percentages of how many sets I lost to what I sold, and the proportion came out very well. Well, that took us through to the almost to the start of television, black and white. And I realised we couldn't fight the John Martins and the Myers and the David Jones in those days on advertising, so we started a small advertising campaign in the back of the news, and all we put in there was only about a 5 inch deep by 3 inches wide column in the back there, in the back pages, and everybody was very worried about the cost of servicing and all the troubles we were going to have. So I just said, why buy your set when you can rent one and let us take all the worries? And it started to work. In fact, we were taking calls here by the 100 every night, this house here.
Yes.
And I said to the fellows there concerned, and once I get 4,000 or 5,000 sets in the field, I said, I think I've got the rest of them by the short and curlies, as matter of saying is, because if it's a satisfactory, we put aerials up too for them at the same time. Sure, we lost some sets, some got pinched, but the law of averages worked out. The percentages was quite what I had anticipated, having had the experience of the car radio. Well, we were trading as Filson Electrical Limited. In 1960, a very fortunate thing happened. A terrific number of English migrants came over, and they were used to rental, of course, and they saw this little ad of mine in the paper, in the back of the paper, and they said, oh, radio rentals, they must be here in Adelaide. Well, they weren't, but we just said we had a radio rental service. Yeah. So I said to the accountant, look, for God's sake, get down to the company's office and cancel Filson Electrical Limited and re-register Radio Rentals Limited. This didn't please Radio Rentals Limited in England very much because they were a bit stymied and they couldn't open up here. They did open up and eventually as Baird, and they're still going in a small way, yes. But the name Radio Rentals has taken on, and of course away we went with the black and white sets in that era, and I think the first year we put out around about 10,000 sets, and I suppose that at the moment it'd be only 30 or 40,000 still out on colour.
On rental.
So we must have handled some hundreds of thousands of sets in that period from now. I forget, I did have a check one time to something out 300,000 or 400,000 we've handled. And it's been a quite successful operation. Of course, it's always been backed by the service division, because I've always believed there that, having been in the country, to know that if you sell something, then you don't fix it up, you don't sell the next lot of stuff too easily. So the same applies to town. If you get a good deal from your local garage man, then he does a few jobs for you, always go back there again. And I've got a garage here. I mean, I always get my petrol there. One little welding job done, it's usually done for me almost at no charge, you know. Now, the same thing applies if you can get a good supplier who does the right thing all the time for you and gives you a fair deal. You'll keep going back there. Why change? So this is the basis of which the rental business built up to. Now, of course, it's expanded since then. In 1965, I think we started off with the white goods business, with the refrigerators, and then we went into washing machines with air conditioners, right across the board now, and including now we've got a business section for computers.
Yes.
Which is also very satisfactory, all based on exactly the same idea that you can rent it for as long as you like, or if you can rent it and you can buy it and you can do what you like. But it's been very successful, and it's been one of the fortunate things that has happened.
Do you find that people do rent computers? Like,
oh yes, one dozen. Oh yes, especially you often get people there wanting a computer perhaps for 12 months. They want to find out, do the kids really want a computer? Well, sometimes they'll take somebody else who's had a computer, doesn't want it anymore, and they've just finished the rental period, so they can take one of those over at a much reduced rate to what they would get a new one.
Yes.
Or else they can update regularly. A lot of people keep it for 2 years, then they update to something else. Now, the old one is ideally situated for somebody just starting off, so the same thing with TV sets. I mean, they may want to update again to something with receiving the Skylab or something like that, so rather they return the other one. We also quite often just recently have pulled out a lot of sets that are 12 years old and put new sets in their place. Now, those old sets there, we often give them away for $10 or $12 to people who've been with us for a long time, so they've got a second set.
Yes.
But the whole secret of the rental plan is to make sure that the set in the service division, everything we rent before we put out, is checked by the service division to make sure that it's serviceable and can be serviced, because I've stuck one particular set one time here, you couldn't put the pilot globes in. It was a Phillips set too, as a matter of fact. They just overlooked, they'd put the pilot globe in before they assembled it. And when they went to change the globe, they just couldn't get the hand in, so he had to retool it. Now, this has happened quite a few occasions. I've stopped stuff. I've been down the workshop there, and I said, well, I want to have a look at that set before you put it out. Some sets, I take you half an hour to get out the cabinet. The old set was made by Industries in Melbourne. They'd had a drop-back chassis, and you could undo that chassis with two wing nuts and just drop it back in your lap, and you could work on it within 5 minutes. And other sets I've seen to the factories, you're there for half an hour before you can get the damn thing in and out. On the rental game, of course, it's very critical that if the people want a set fixed up today, they want it fixed up today, not next week.
And also, you're paying for the service yourselves, aren't you?
Yes,
the rental,
that's
so you've
right.
got to service them more efficiently.
Pretty much like joining the RAA. I mean, they can afford to have blokes standing by because they've got a fixed source of income.
Yes.
Just turn it off. Where did we get to?
Okay.
Yeah, so the service division on a rental plan is a very, very critical part of it, and it pays us. I mean, for the simple reason, once you get the number of sets out, you can put on a fixed number of technicians, and even if they don't work, you know that there's something coming in all the time.
Yes. What proportion of rental sets would you have compared to sales?
Well, it's pretty hard, Ian, because some of them convert at the end of 2 years into a sale, some of them don't convert at all. I would say 3/4 of the sets continue to be rented.
Do they?
But they vary from month to month or year to year sometimes. There's a whole swag there that they decide to buy. We don't care what they do, but a lot of them often will take a set out. Well, you know, with a car, I mean, you get a crook car, and I mean, you're landed with it.
Yes.
And a lot of people say, oh, I'd rather rent the TV set and just see how good it is. And see, in the early days, the black and white sets, you used to get problems there with some of the sets, with the valve trouble there, and people couldn't appreciate it. It wasn't the set, it was only the valves that were giving the trouble. They still didn't want it, they just used to swap mode because of the valve problem.
Yes.